Welcome to Chapters, the podcast where we hear the stories of readers' lives through the books that have meant the most to them. I'm Mary Mahoney, and today I'm talking with Casper Terkyle. Casper is the author of How We Gather, A Cultural Map of Millennial Communities, and the co-founder of the UK Youth Climate Coalition and Campaign Bootcamp. He's a graduate of Harvard's Divinity and Kennedy Schools and training to be a minister for non-religious people. His work has been featured in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and on NPR. Casper is also the co-host of a podcast entitled Harry Potter and the Sacred Text, along with Vanessa Zoltan. Their podcast aims to read Harry Potter as an instructive and inspirational text that can teach readers about their own lives. Today, we're going to hear how the books he's read have helped him to understand the world and his place within it. So, Casper Terkyle, did I say your name correctly?
Yeah, just okay. Right.
Casper Terkyle, it just rolls right off the tongue. Thank you so much for being on the show. I'm so excited to get a chance to speak with you today.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. I'm wondering if maybe you could tell us a little bit about where you're from and maybe just kind of start by thinking about your earliest memories of reading.
Yeah, I grew up in the southeast of England in a little village called Forest Row. My parents are both Dutch, so they moved to the UK just before I was born. So we spoke a lot of Dutch at home, and we were read to a lot as kids. But I think the first books that I really remember are these old books, I think from like the 1920s, one called A Hole is to Dig, which we read in my parents' bed as kids. Like, we would creep in on a Sunday morning and like read that together. Those are probably my earliest memories of reading myself. I was actually not a big reader but certainly not as a teen. Really, the only books that I read between the ages of maybe like 12 and 18 were Agatha Christie books.
Oh, really?
I was totally obsessed with Agatha. I have like, I think she wrote 79 like mystery stories in total, and I have like 58 of them in the same edition. And I was like,
whoa.
very proud of that.
When did you first pick up Agatha Christie?
You know, I think it might have been my mom who like slipped me one at our like shared family house in Holland, because I was like very bored, you know. And she's like, oh, have a read of this. But I haven't, like, I'm not a big mystery reader. I didn't read anyone else, like just Agatha Christie. It's still very strange to me why that was.
Yeah, I think I remember in episode 2 of your podcast, you mentioned going to boarding school and bringing Agatha Christie with you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's where I built the collection. So like every week on a Sunday afternoon, I worked in a pub and I earned about £25 usually on my shift. And I would spend like 5 of those pounds on a Thursday afternoon. I'd go to W.H. Smith's, which is like a stationery shop and bookshop. And I would buy another book in that same edition. I'd be like very excited about that kind of pilgrimage into town every Thursday afternoon.
Oh, wow. Do you still read Agatha Christie now, or are you Christie'd out?
I'm pretty Christie'd out. I mean, it's the kind of reading. Yeah, I really haven't read anything in a long time. But what's so wonderful is that A, you don't know who did it, but B, it's just like, it's so English and it's so, it's like so over the top. I just loved it. And I was a Miss Marple over Poirot guy. I really like the like old lady detective style.
Oh yeah, for sure. So you weren't a Sherlock Holmes person?
Yeah, not really. No other kind of mystery stuff has ever really worked for me. I'm just true to Agatha to the end.
Wow. So that was through boarding school. You didn't really read too much except for your pal Agatha. But when did you actually start reading kind of beyond that? When did reading become a part of your bigger part of your life?
I read Naomi Klein's No Logo when I was like 18, I think, in my last year of high school. And that really awakened my kind of inner activist. And so I would say for the next nearly a decade, I really read mostly nonfiction and became, you know, really interested in kind of questions of justice and environmental activism, particularly, was my thing. So I read a lot around that, and still not a huge fiction reader. And really, that's only come back for me since starting Divinity School 3 years ago, kind of unexpectedly. I came to America to do a public policy degree, but kept meeting these really interesting people across campus and decided to do a joint degree and ended up in the Divinity School. And I you know, in divinity school, you have to take required classes like Introduction to Hebrew Bible and Introduction to New Testament. And, you know, we read those books, and it was interesting. You learn all the stories behind them and how they're constructed from different sources, et cetera, et cetera. But, and I, you know, I know Bible stories just because growing up in a broadly Christian culture, but they always felt kind of like foreign texts to me. I didn't grow up in a religious household. And this, you know, I tell this story on the podcast of going traveling with my family and, you know, wanted something to read that would kind of help me, just comfort reading, you know, classic, something to take you away, something to make you feel good. And I'd read the Harry Potter novels, I think, when I was pretty young, in my very early teens, and had enjoyed them. I wasn't like someone who went to the midnight openings. I wasn't a Potterhead in any way. But I reread them when I was like in my late mid-20s, and just I was like, oh my gosh, these are all the same themes that these Bible stories are about are in this wizarding world. And I felt like I could claim this text in a way that I didn't really want to claim the Bible. And so that was really exciting to me, because it's like, oh, this could totally be a sacred text. And through the encouragement of some professors and Vanessa Zoltan, who's my kind of co-founder in this Harry Potter as a Sacred Text work that we've been doing together, she had already been doing this with Jane Eyre, leading a group reading Jane Eyre as a sacred text. And I was like, well, that's cool, but like, no one has read Jane Eyre. Why don't we do it with Harry Potter?
You had never read Jane Eyre?
I still haven't read Jane Eyre.
Oh, no.
I'm so badly read. It's very embarrassing to talk
to you. No, 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 no. You're actually the second person on this podcast who has copped to never reading Jane Eyre. And their excuse was that it was assigned in school, therefore it became repellent to them.
I saw the play. I saw the National Theatre.
That counts. We'll count
it. I know what happens in the story. Maybe it's actually on my shelf. I'm looking at it right now, but I have not.
Listen,
read it.
You're not in trouble. Okay. We're not going to arrest you. We're not going to put you in chapters jail. It's totally fine. It's totally fine. I'm wondering if we could maybe go back a little bit. So when you mentioned going to nonfiction, when you were 18 years old and becoming interested in social justice, what was going on in your life that made you seek out those kind of books, and what kind of books did you go to, and where did it take you?
Well, I came out in high school, and that was definitely an experience of, like, you know, being in the minority, not the majority. And so I think I was just really switched on to questions of who was at the margins of society in a way that, probably the rest of my, you know, family and friends perhaps might not have been. I grew up in a very kind of upper middle class home, went to a good school, all that kind of stuff. And so when I realized that this was, you know, that these books were a place where I could, from which I could learn something different than what was being presented to me in the classroom or through the kind of dominant culture, that was very exciting. So it was kind of, you know, subversive education. And I remember just reading about alternative ideas on economic structures and being like, oh my God, wow, this is so different from what I was being taught. I kept an essay from my economics class where literally I was given big red ticks for writing, yes, it is good to send, you know, for companies to move to the developing world because there are lower human rights and environmental standards there. You know, that was what I was being taught in my economics classroom. So to find things that, you know, exposed sweatshop labor or exposed environmental degradation, I was like, wow, this is really cool. And so that, yeah, it was a very empowering feeling to kind of read those kind of books. Yeah.
I think it's so interesting to hear you talk about nonfiction that way, because when most people think of connecting to books or trying to find an outlet for themselves, trying to imagine the life they want, a lot of people talk about fiction that way. But I think it's so interesting the way you talk about nonfiction that way. There was a line in episode 2 of your podcast that really intrigued me when you were talking about the scene in which Harry is going to the zoo with his cousin and he connects with the snake. They look at each other and they connect, and then the glass between the snake and the people disappears and hijinks ensue. And I don't know if it was you or Vanessa who said, this is the first living thing Harry Potter connected with. And I was trying to actually think about reading that way. You know, when we find books and we think, this is a living thing I've connected with. And for you, it sounds like it was nonfiction.
I think And I mean, I should say, like, I had a very happy home life and was well loved. But at the same time, I think definitely, I mean, that No Logo book particularly, it felt maybe less like being seen for the first time in a way that we talked about with Harry, but it was more like a door opening. Like, I didn't know this world of justice, like activism, existed. Like, no one worked for a charity in my social experience, you know, like that. It just wasn't very present. And this just gave me a window into, especially seeing what young people were doing in terms of leading on justice issues. I was like, wow, like I can do that. And that was a hugely exciting moment. Yeah. So I mean, that glass kind of did disappear, but it was more like a new landscape opening for me of options that were, you know, open to me, which I'd never considered.
Yeah. I'm wondering if for people listening who haven't read that book, can you maybe tell us a little bit about what it's about?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. It's going back a long time ago. Yeah. So essentially it was written, I think, mostly during the early 2000s. And Naomi Klein kind of tells a story of how companies are using brands to sell products at like way more, you know, essentially the profit is made on the brand story and the brand promise. So something like Nike or Nike is a really big example where Sweatshop Labor produces shoes, which as soon as they have the swoosh added to them, sell at like 5-6 times the amount that they would without the swoosh. And that the promise of, you know, a brand like that, which is about sports and excellence and, you know, all sorts of positive values, actually behind that is a very, very murky kind of history of slave labor and poor environmental practices. And so that the story in front and behind the screen are totally different. And how, you know, the kind of brand story has captured the market and a generation. And Naomi Klein is talking about essentially how you can kind of subvert that by refusing to be branded in your life. And I mean, in that, of course, there's all sorts of, you know, then you get the whole kind of like No Logo movement of, yeah, I don't want to be branded. And that itself then kind of becomes a brand. So there's always really interesting. But essentially she was taking the kind of veneer off the world that I knew and showing me what was underneath it, just informing me of stuff that I, in my little privileged bubble, had just never even thought about. Right. So that was a very kind of eye-opening experience.
Hmm. So then what do you do with that? So you read this book, your mind is totally blown. And then it's kind of like the real challenge. What happens next?
Well, I was very lucky because I went on Google and I was like, young people, justice, things. You know, like, what do I do? And it just happened that the year of my graduation from high school was the World Youth Congress was being held in Scotland. This happened every 3 years, brought 600 to 800 young people together from around the world who were leading on sustainable development justice work. And because it was hosted in the UK, there were extra places for young Brits who hadn't really done anything yet, but were really passionate and interested. And I was lucky enough to be given a place at this conference. So suddenly I spend like 5 days with, you know, a Brazilian guy who has a TV show about HIV/AIDS, like sexual health awareness, with an Indian woman who is leading sustainable energy infrastructure in her region of India. Like, just these people, wow, who are doing the most amazing things and demonstrating what people can do. And so I ended up going to university that fall and like threw myself into kind of a number of different activist groups. And first, really building stuff on campus, like, you know, changing recycling rules and, you know, making all the chocolate and coffee and tea fair trade. And but then also kind of starting to think about what the university is investing its money in. That really kind of, you know, just brought me in touch with other people doing the same kind of thing and giving me opportunities to, you know, lobby EU representatives in Brussels and Westminster and starting to kind of think more big scale.
Hmm. Really interesting. Is that what led you to get a public policy degree in Harvard?
Yeah. Yeah. So I ended up, once I graduated, I kind of worked in the nonprofit world, particularly around environmental sustainability, for 3 years, and ended up setting up two organizations that were about mobilizing young people. But I started looking at my bosses and I was like, I kind of don't want to just do what I'm doing here. I think there's something else. And I was a a bit lost. And so the thing that I knew would be useful was a public policy degree. And I kind of sensed that I might do well in America, that that might be a place for me. Both my parents had lived there and my grandparents had lived there for some time. And I kind of on a hunch made that decision to come here.
Hmm. Now, you've mentioned your family sort of in passing. I'm just wondering, in your life as a reader, are books a way that you connect with your family? Do you ever read books in common with them?
It was less about reading together. We certainly, stories have played a big part in our household. Every 23rd of December, so the day before Christmas Eve, as long as I can remember, we've hosted a storyteller to come and tell a Christmas carol. And I live in a very strange, wonderful village because there's an international school of storytelling. So we often host people who are taking those classes. We run a bed and breakfast in our house. But the guy who ran that school for a long time was a dear family friend. And he would come with, you know, just a hat, two kind of coats and a hat stand and a chair and one kind of light shining up from the floor on him. And our living room would be packed with about 40 people kind of sitting on the floor and on top of sofas and things like that. And he would tell the whole Christmas carol, which, you know, took about an hour and a half off by heart. He knows the whole thing. You know, he knows all these stories. And our family quotes lines from that story over and over again. So there's this wonderful scene at the beginning when the ghost of Jacob Marley kind of brings his chains, clank, 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 up the stairs to meet Scrooge, to warn him of his encounter with these three ghosts to come. And, Scrooge is terrified and he's like, oh, Jacob, you're always a good man. You know, you're always a good man of business. And then Marley's ghost says, business, humanity was my business. Which, my dad was an investment banker, so it was always a great moment. there's just so many of those lines that are just totally in our family jokes and we'll just say them to each other. So there were things like that, which were not really reading, but definitely experiencing story. And I mean, it's Dickens, right? It's literature. So
yeah, kind of performing it together. Ways. I can't imagine living in a bed and breakfast where there's an institute of storytelling, presumably down the street. That just completely blows my mind. I just can't imagine the stories you've heard, the storytellers you've met. And I'm wondering, you know, if any stand out, but also did that kind of consciously or not influence your own capacity to tell stories or to think about narrative in your life? I mean, I think I've heard you use the phrase making meaning, or meaning making is important to you. And I'm wondering, like, if that there's any connection there.
Yeah. I definitely think it, you know, it's influenced how I think about my life. Certainly, you know, I, last summer for the first time hosted on Midsummer, a kind of, an evening at a friend's house who has some land, outside of Boston. We, made a bonfire and we camped out and we read A Midsummer Night's Dream, kind of, everyone, you know, took a part and we just read the play during the evening. And that kind of, you know, I just grew up doing weird things like that. So for me, it's not that weird, but for other people, they're like, what is going on? This is awesome. So I guess the permission to play with stories and to feel like you don't have to be a professional to create something amazing with it. I mean, the phrase meaning making, it really comes from divinity school. So we actually have a class called meaning making where, you get together every week with your peers and, someone brings a case from the work that they're doing off campus, and you try and kind of bring theological resources to help that person think through the situation that they're in. A lot of the theological resources are often stories, whether they're stories from a faith tradition. I mean, Dumbledore often gets raised in those contexts because it's just, you know, it's like a wise person who people like me grew up with. So you often hear Dumbledore as often as you do Jesus in those kind of classroom experiences, which is a lot of fun. But it's really about kind of offering the person who's maybe stuck or finding it difficult to cope with this difficult relational situation a new way to think about the context that they're in. So that's that's where that phrase meaning.
And I'm wondering too if you're preparing to be a chaplain for non-religious people, if then that creates an even bigger space for literature or stories more broadly to kind of stand in as an authority or as a resource.
Definitely. And I think, you know, something, and this may be generational or it may be timeless, but I think, you know, especially people who are not, who don't see themselves as religious, are very, very skeptical of any sort of, you know, authoritative advice from, you know, from the world of religion. But I think what the best kind of ministers do is just tell stories. And you can see yourself in different characters in the story, and you can experience a challenge in a new way by thinking from it from a different perspective, or, you know, just to see a bigger picture or a bigger context in this other story. And it often takes the sting out of a conversation if you can talk about the story rather than what's like actually happening for you right now. So I think it's a really key skill in ministry is learning how to tell stories.
And I guess I'm wondering if that can possibly go wrong. So if your role is to kind of help people from maybe drawing harmful conclusions from books, I was really interested to listen. I think in episodes 1 and 2, you use, I hope I say this right, Lectio Divina.
Yeah.
Which is a process of reading in which you pick a random passage and then analyze that passage narratively, allegorically. You reflect on how the passage might speak to your own life, and then try to receive an invitation from the text, either in the form of an action or a thought.
Right.
And I was really, really intrigued by this, partially because the random selection of a passage, which I've always known as bibliomancy, is something that really intrigues me. So that has a very long history of randomly selecting a passage and then taking that as a form of knowledge or directive. But I'm wondering if, you know, perchance somebody, say, picks up Harry Potter or Jane Eyre, God help us all, and they open Jane Eyre and randomly select a passage and then draw from that passage something that's actually not affirming or not necessarily the best message. Like, how would you maybe step in and try to help them?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So we were really inspired by St. Augustine, who... his approach to Lectio Divina is basically like you should be able to take any phrase or even an individual word from the Bible, and you should be able to read it towards God is love. Like, that should be the conclusion that you draw. So it's kind of stating the goal before you've even engaged in the game. But so his approach was like, you haven't reached the truth until you've realized that this sentence means God is love. And so... we tried to adapt that a little bit when we did our in-person reading group of Harry Potter and the Sacred Text, where we said, you know, what we're going to read towards, and this was an arbitrary choice for us, but love is stronger than fear. So that was what we invited the group to read towards throughout the year. Mm. And so when we would get stuck, you know, and you have a sentence like, I know, he chopped off Harry's finger, and I don't know, like just something like maybe a very violent image or very boring image, like, you know, the cupboard was empty. Okay, well, what are we going to do with that? So, and it's really an exercise of the imagination to try and get to that place of like, okay, well, let's think about if the cupboard is empty. What does that say? Well, someone's had the courage to leave the cupboard, or, you know, you have to kind of be creative with it. And so that's often a really helpful thing when you're working with a text. The way we've decided to do it with the podcast is to try and come up with a kind of a theme each week and have that as our kind of what we're reading toward. And it's a bit of an experiment still for us. And you know, every week we're like, well, what should next week's theme be? Generosity? Okay, let's read towards generosity and see what we find. And it's really just a way of keeping the text fresh and you just get a different angle on something, which is often really, really fun. But no doubt, I mean, it's a process, and a process can be used, you know, for good or ill. So you could also read that fear is stronger than love, you know, and I'm sure you'd find a whole bunch of you know, interesting material within the text. So that's, I guess, where you have to kind of maybe have an intention before you engage with the text.
Hmm. Interesting. Have you ever done bibliomancy yourself with any other books?
Is that where you tell me?
So
more
you
about
just this. Randomly flip to a page of a book and you pick a passage and you accept that as a source of knowledge for you to think about. So people historically have done this as like almost fortune telling. So they open it and say, Robert Browning did it when he was trying to figure out if he should propose to Elizabeth Barrett.
Wow.
Yeah. The
That's
stakes
not a
cannot be
decision
higher.
I would leave to human books randomly.
Exactly, exactly. But and we've actually spoken to other people on this show who have used newspapers, all kinds of things. So this goes back to ancient texts and people still do it today. So I'm just always on the lookout for people who do this.
Yeah, I mean, people definitely do that with the Bible, certainly. I mean, what I like about Lectio Divina, and we've altered stages a little bit to fit our project, but what I like about that practice is that it forces us to engage with it at a number of levels. So you can't just take the text at face value. You have to interrogate it a little bit more, which just sometimes takes you to a different place than it would have if you just read the text as it stands. So I like that kind of a little bit of depth and not just accepting it at face value.
Yeah, no, I think it's, and I like the invitation to reflect on your own life because I'm sure that for listeners and people in your reading group that that has been
Yeah.
inspirational.
Yeah. Yeah. And not always easy, because it can be very challenging, and we've ended up, one of the great gifts of doing it in a community over really about 6, 7 months was building a kind of sense of intimacy and trust to explore real questions about death and loss, particularly, which is such a big theme, obviously, in the Harry Potter books. But I think it was an opportunity for people to explore, in real time, parents who were sick or dying or grief that had been there a long time and maybe hadn't had the air to breathe in the way that it did in that time every Wednesday evening. So that was a real gift for us as facilitators.
So when did that group start? So you went on holiday, you read Harry Potter, and you noticed it was very similar to a lot of the biblical texts you were reading. And then you came back, and then what happened?
Well, so I talked about it with a professor of mine, and she said, "Well, you've got to talk to Vanessa Zoltan. She's doing exactly the same thing with Jane Eyre." So Vanessa and I got together, and we had breakfast every Monday morning for about really from about March through to September, which is when we started the class. And we had, very consistently about 25, 30 people every Wednesday evening reading it, a chunk of about 7, 8 chapters at a time every week. It was a lot of fun. Every beginning of the class, we would hang the Hogwarts banner to kind of open our time together, and someone would give a 3-minute recap of what had happened in those kind of that chunk of chapters. And then we'd really explore, very similarly as we do in the podcast, we'd explore some themes that came up, and then engage either in Lectio Divina or a kind of guided meditation using a text to kind of ourselves into the text and experience it firsthand and see what we smelt or what we could feel or whether other people who are not on the page but that were there for us when we were in the story. It was just different practices to bring the text alive and then usually work in small groups to kind of go a little bit deeper and then come to a close towards the end of the evening.
So I'm interested when you mention senses. Did people report having sensory experiences reading Harry Potter?
I think it's difficult not to. There's wonderful writing, particularly the food. So that's always it's a good way in. I think we were. I wouldn't say the sensory reading was a really prominent part of the work that we did. We'd often really stay at a kind of thematic level, but sometimes in the guided meditations we would go into more of the, walking into the forest, for example, or discovering the mirror of Erised and imagining what would we see if the mirror of Erised was there, which is the mirror of desire. Desire backwards is Erised. Or encountering a boggart, which kind of shape shifts into whatever your greatest fear is, which was a nice way for us to kind of in small groups explore the fears that we had and why. So it was often using senses in that kind of way.
Interesting. It sounds like a very intense, kind of a higher level book club in a way. And I'm wondering, I have a friend who's British who read Harry Potter and said to me that he thought Harry Potter made him homesick for Hogwarts in a weird way, which was strange for him because it's a place that doesn't exist. And I'm wondering, did you have any similar feelings?
Well, just because it's all in your head doesn't mean it's not real,
Right,
as Dumbledore
exactly.
is famous to say. I think Hogwarts is a very real place for a lot of people. I think that's something we've learned, and there's some incredible stories of it offers a real safe haven in times of, it's a really resilient tool, I think, for a whole bunch of people. So it's less about escape and more about kind of maybe sanctuary, to use that religious term. So certainly that was a very, very common theme. And a lot of people joined the group because they said, every time I have a breakup, that's when I reach for Harry Potter, or as my mother was dying, these are the books that I read to give me comfort and hope. And I think in part these books are so powerful for that, not just as a kind of first time, young adult reader, but for adults to come back to it again and again, is because it does have that it explores big questions and in a generous, thoughtful way. So yeah, that's something I have to say. I found it most engaging with a text every day like that, because usually I'd read about a chapter a day to prepare for the class the next week. And so for a good year and a nearly a year and a half now, I've been kind of having that text with me. And so the daily encounters that I have with a difficult situation or a stressful meeting, or one of the places where my brain goes very quickly is to images or stories or things from the Harry Potter series to help me make sense of what I'm experiencing. So it definitely feels like a real place to me in that sense.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. I know you were teaching the class, but I mean, did this experience teach you things about yourself? So you were helping other people to engage with Harry Potter to help with a breakup or deal with grief or whatever need people had coming to this class. But I'm wondering if there were things you experienced that you didn't expect, lessons you didn't expect.
And I should say I'm making it sound like very serious and intense. Like we had a lot of fun, But I think actually that's what I learned is how amazing it is to engage in a text with other people who are taking it as seriously as you are. Like the creative and just amazingly interesting readings that people came up with from, something that I thought I was like, oh yeah, I've got this figured out, and someone would come in and think like, actually no, I think the fact that the writing on the cake is green and Harry's eyes are green and the ink on the Hogwarts letter is green, like there's something going on there. And I was like, wow, I hadn't even noticed that. So the just the joy and the pleasure of engaging with rigor in a text-based exploration. Which, if I guess if you grew up with Bible study in your house, maybe that's something that isn't news to you. But for me, that was just like, whoa, this is very cool. And it made me want to think like, wow, what would happen if I did that with a Christmas Carol or with the stories that I know really well elsewhere. I think it's such an invitation to yeah, take texts seriously. That
Yeah.
was a big takeaway for me.
Something I'm noticing is that we haven't really talked about J.K. Rowling at all. So I'm just wondering where the author fits into this way of reading or if she fits in at all. I mean, do you ever think about her when you're teaching the class or doing the podcast?
We've very purposefully engaged with the text and not with the story around the text. I think Joanne Rowling is fabulous. Her Harvard commencement speech is just one of the great speeches of all time, I think. And I really respect her for the work that she's done. She's a big supporter of the British Labour Party, as am I. So that's one thing. I think it does matter in the sense of I felt comfortable choosing this text because I feel comfortable with the values that J.K. Rowling has exhibited in her work outside of this text. So a real commitment to helping others and to doing good in the world. That is important to me. And at the same time, I think you can't, or at least we have chosen not to ask the question, well, why did the author write this? Or maybe the author has made a mistake here with A, B, and C. For us, that's a really boring conversation. It's much more interesting to say like, huh, this time traveler stuff seems to be like really complex. But instead of saying, well, oh, she just made a mistake or whatever, and just say like, well, what if this was on purpose? Like, let's imagine what it might mean. And really come back to that, imaginative invitation again. Because I listen to, I'm a huge Game of Thrones fan. So I listen to a couple of Game of Thrones podcasts, and so often people end up talking about like, oh, the lighting was bad in that scene, or like, oh, I can't stand the storyline about Dawn. And on one level, like, I totally agree with them, you know, like, let's critique the show, and that bit just didn't feel as good. But it's so much more fun. Like, now that I've done this with one text, I want to do it with all the things around me. You know, when I consume culture, I'm like, well, let's like, what, okay, fine, this Dawn storyline feels flat, but like, what can we learn from that? You know, and it takes away that cynical, judgy voice that I'm very good at, and brings it somewhere much more productive.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think the focus on being positive is and useful is really important. Taking the text as it is and trying to make it useful for your life. So I'm wondering where this is going next. Like, what books are you reading now?
Well, actually, right on my desk right now is The Diaries of Etty Hillesum, who was killed in the concentration camps. She was a Dutch woman in her late 20s. She's the kind of Anne Frank, but is having sex. Like, she's really amazing, amazing woman who's just writing about, you know, life as a 27-year-old in Amsterdam. And she happens to be Jewish, and it happens to be 1942. So that's what I'm reading right now. You know, I'm still not a huge fiction reader, and I've tried, having read Harry Potter, you know, a couple times now, again with this kind of methodology, I've been exploring, like, oh, let me try Sabriel, let me try some of these other kind of, I mean, I loved Philip Pullman's trilogy, but I have to say, I'm just still not a huge fantasy or mystery or fiction reader. It's just, yeah, I don't know why it works with the Potter books, and it just hasn't. I sometimes hunger for something to escape to. So if you've got any good recommendations, let me know. But I have to say, most of the books out of the library and on my shelf are definitely nonfiction. So I've stayed where I came from, I
So
guess.
even Agatha's, she's out.
Agatha is out. Yeah, she's still in England. Not on my shelves here in Cambridge.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I'm wondering maybe before we close, if there's one book that you would want to recommend to our listeners, what would that book be? You can say more than one.
Oh my gosh. Well, I'll recommend a book that I was just talking about yesterday, which really changed my life in divinity school, because it gave me the permission to use the language of ministry in a way that I never would have. And it's called The Wounded Healer by Henry Nouwen. And I mean, the link to me is obvious. He was like a closeted gay Catholic Dutch priest who worked at Harvard Divinity School.
That's very
I was
intense,
like,
yeah.
oh wait, yeah, this is very familiar. Except the closeted part, at least not anymore. But what I love about that book is it kind of explores, well, what will ministry look like in the future? And he's writing in the 70s, so he's really writing about what it will look like today. And it was so resonant to me, and it touches on what we talked about before about, you know, the importance of questions instead of answers, and about you know, giving opportunities to explore life's big questions together, which I think is part of why this Harry Potter project has been so much fun for us. So if, you know, if leading that kind of stuff is interesting, and leading people in their reading is interesting, I think this might be a kind of left field but very useful book. So yeah, The Wounded Healer by Henry Nouwen.
Do you think then your work is a piece of maybe what he's calling for? If people are less religious now, is this a way forward for ministry for people who are hungry for something, even if it doesn't take the shape of religion?
Oh, for sure. Can you imagine if, like, every church offered reading groups that took, it wasn't just a book club, it asked life's big questions, but through these texts? I think people would love it. I'm like, yeah, totally about it.
Actually, there's a short story that was published in 1916 that imagines a minister visiting a friend who's a physician, and he has set up his office in a former church that has closed down. The congregation is gone, and he has set it up and called it a bibliotherapeutic clinic. So
Wow.
people come in, and he prescribes them novels to read based on their problems. So, in a sense, that world already
Wow.
exists in fiction, but maybe
As it
this is a
always
way
does.
forward. Exactly. So I will definitely have to send you that story. But
Oh, please do.
yes, well, thank you so much for speaking with us today. This was such a delight. Thank you.
You, Mary, I'm so glad to have been here. Thank you.
Anytime. I'd like to thank our guest, Casper, for sharing his story with us. Visit our website, www.chapterspod.com, if you'd like to share your story on Chapters. We are dedicated to sharing the stories of readers' lives through the books that have meant the most to them. On our website, you can also find links to every book mentioned on this and every episode. You can follow us at ChaptersPod on Twitter and find us on Facebook. I'm Mary Mahoney, and you can follow me at MaryMahoney123. I'd like to thank our technical director, Taylor, who engineered and produced this episode and also wrote our theme music. She can be found on Twitter at MJTThePhD. Thanks for listening to Chapters.